everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is a special in-depth presentation on the deep state. In this series, we're looking from different perspectives of who are the deep state members? How did they evolve? What was their origin? How do they manifest today? In our program today, continuing with our conversations with Remarkable Minds, and a different look at the deep state is Danny Sheehan. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. And during the past 46, 47 years, he's handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, a Karen Silkwood murder case. He is on top a lot, and in the last couple of years, he's been out there helping the Native Nations and the Chase Iron Eyes, the only person arrested for inciting a riot at Standing Rock against the North Dakota state government and private corporations building the pipeline. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute, the latter being a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. Danny has a law degree from Harvard University and later returned to study at the Harvard Divinity School. He is the author of The People's Advocate, and his websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, that's Sheehan.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. I'm delighted to be here.
Danny, on previous discussions, you have gone into depth about the founding of the deep state, the players, and how they were financed and the different characters throughout history. But today, I believe we're at a unique place, and that is because of the election being won by Donald Trump, I believe that the deep state panicked. They had absolute certainty of belief that Hillary Clinton would win. And why not? Every single major corporate interest in the United States, every group of institutions, Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, the military spying complex, all government major agencies supported her. She was supported by Big Agra, Monsanto. They all supported her. The mainstream media completely supported her, from the Washington Post to the New York Times, CNN, all supported her. But the people did not. And for it was not, I believe, a vote for Trump, but rather it was a vote against all the promises made by Barack Obama, George Bush, Hillary Clinton, and her husband, Bill Clinton, when they were in the White House, and George Bush Sr. So everyone has made promises and then broken them. And as a result, we have lost millions of jobs. In just one 12-year period, 54,000 factories closed up, many going to other countries. So the unions were decimated, debt was piled on. And now if you're the average person, you're thinking, wow, if I don't pay this parking ticket, I could go to a debtor's prisons that are privately owned and the media doesn't care, politicians don't care, I have no advocates for me, and I'm along with about 250 million other Americans, we're now the new poor. No one talks about us. They're just talking about the booming economy for the professional class and the entrepreneurial class, which represents about, more or less, with children and all, about 100 million people. You've got 10 million millionaires, and you've got 17 million professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, accountants, CPAs, architects, and professors, and entrepreneurs. So when you add those two together, you're at 100 million people. With 330 million people, that leaves about 230 million people who have little except debt, which they can't pay, student debt that they can't pay. And yet nothing was changing. There was absolutely nothing at all to create universal health care, to eliminate student debt, to eliminate payday loans and high usurious interest rates. Nothing was being done to get rid of genetically engineered material, to deal with global warming, to help to create a sustainable future. Nothing was being done to bring a higher rate of literacy into our schools, making schools a prosperous place for intellectual discussion and discourse. So nothing that mattered was working, except people were working 2 to 3 jobs and still were in debt. And so then when they lost, when the corporate Democrats lost, and this person became president with all of his deficiencies, his one deficiency was the most terrifying, and that was he was unpredictable and uncontrollable. So that's what they overreacted to. And as a result, they started this whole Russia hacked into the Democratic National Committee, and that's where all the emails that about John Podesta and Hillary Clinton, about Aberdeen, and that's where it all came from. That's never been proven. Our research showed that just the opposite was true, that that came from an insider working inside the DNC. We believe that person's name is Seth. We believe that that Seth person gave those documents in a thumb drive of everything that was wrong and corrupt to the former ambassador from Great Britain. And then that person met in a park across from American University in Washington, D.C., and that's where the exchange occurred. He then got them into the hands of Julian Assange of Wikipedia, or WikiLeaks, and that's how this all came. So instead of looking for the truth, the American media all went after Trump. And instead of doing investigations that were objective, the Justice Department, Mueller, all went after trying to find anything that could get him out of office. And there is where our story begins for you, Danny, because it's at that moment that I believe that the deep state, using the power it had inside the CIA, the National Security Agency, the FBI and Justice Department, and the White House, raised its ugly head, and the monsters came out of the swamp in Washington, and for the first time in my lifetime, actually showed us who they were, at least in part, because they had so much at risk if they couldn't control, as they completely controlled Obama, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Jr. and Sr., and would have controlled Hillary Clinton, but they couldn't control him. Your thoughts on that, and take us from there into what you see the dangers of the deep state being. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, that it's extraordinary that that so many people from different kind of worldviews and ideological perspectives can agree with such an extraordinarily high percentage of each of the points that you have made. There is this general question that still remains as to exactly what the source of the documents were that went to Wikipedia. But our position is, my position has been, is that if Wikipedia exists to reveal inside secrets of either major political parties or political institutions that reveal the wrongdoing of those people, that is, in fact, a public service. And that, therefore, the information that was given out about the inside activities inside the Democratic Party that were designed to suppress the support for Bernie Sanders and to suppress the support for the public policy positions that he and his followers were advocating, that many of which you have listed about the single-payer health system, the provision of the support for people to go to college, et cetera, the protection, the genuine protection of the environment, et cetera, that the revelation of those machinations that went on inside the Democratic Party to support Hillary Clinton and to suppress the vote for Bernie Sanders was an important public service. Now, what we need to look at here is what it is that can be done at the present time in response to what's going on. You again point out something that is very, very underreported now with regard to the activities of Mueller and his people. This is a Gestapo operation that's going on here with Mueller, that he has established what basically amounts to a star chamber. A star chamber is one of the major institutions back in medieval England that was a source of the United States constitutional prohibitions against conduct like this. And a Star Chamber was the king, basically, or the king's men, the king's prosecutors, basically establishing a commission and then reaching out to anybody and everybody in the world, saying that, look, there's a particular individual that we want to get for our own reasons, being the king's men. And we want you to come in and provide any information, any complaints you have against this person, no matter what they are, if they're sexual peccadilloes, financial misdeeds, anything, to come in and provide anything that you can against him. And that we are going to, in fact, send out the king's men, and we're going to break into buildings. We're going to get warrants that are rubber stamped by magistrates to search their files, to search their telephones, to stop their friends at airports and seize their telephones and plunge their telephones to get all the information out of them, you know, break into their lawyers' offices. I mean, that this is a spectacle which is long-term damaging to the major institutions of law and order inside the United States. And the problem is that so many people stand and cheer for these types of activities on the part of Mueller, going, I don't care what he needs to do in order to get this guy out of here. Okay, and so the question that you have posed is, why is it exactly that so many of the people inside this major elite circle want this guy out of there? It certainly can't be because of his sexual activities. I mean, we all know about the kind of rampant misconduct on the part of members of both political parties engaging in promiscuous sexual activity. I mean, all of this holier-than-thou stuff about the fact that he actually went to bed with a pornographic film star, and everybody pretending like they're completely offended by all this, or that he makes remarks which are totally inappropriate about women, all of which is true. But you see the scope of all of that in all kinds of different circles, from Hollywood to Wall Street to all the business sectors, so that the turning of the moral eye of the people onto every single area of conduct on the part of Trump to try to generate an adequate amount of momentum to throw him out of office is very clearly motivated by something different than the particular charges that they're filing against him. Even the judge, as we saw in one of the cases, is saying to the prosecutors, look, you're not really interested in getting charges against this individual that you're targeting here. You're just trying to get this person charged with something so you can get them to roll over on Donald Trump because you want to get rid of him. And said it right on the record. And so this is true. So the question that you put is, what is it? What is the interest of the core of the people that are trying to get rid of Trump, who, after all, even though he was not voted for by a majority of the American people, was in fact elected pursuant to the same exact set of rules that govern the Electoral College and the assignment of members of the Electoral College to the different states that are disproportionate potentially to the population that they have. That is a thing that's been known. That part of the Constitution was put into the Constitution to give these very elite the ability to win, even in the face of popular support for something else. That's what happened here, and now it's sort of backfired on them. And so that this question of who these people are, we've had these discussions a number of times on your show here, and it's really important for people to understand that this term is now being thrown around about the deep state. Even Trump himself, he attempts to conflate the deep state primarily with the bureaucracies in Washington, D.C., the kind of bureaucratic imperative that obtains inside the Justice Department or the CIA or the National Intelligence Community or the Environmental Protection Department, et cetera. He keeps characterizing those bureaucrats, those civil servants that are there all the time as the deep state. That's not what the deep state is. Nor is, in fact, the deep state simply the American intelligence community that has been created by the National Security Act of 1947 that created the Central Intelligence Agency, and then later on the National Security Agency and others that engage in this type of clandestine covert activity all around the world since 1947. The reality is that those institutions, those national security institutions, were created back in 1947 by members of this same much more limited elite that actually created the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency and the others to effectively do their bidding out around the world. And that, as we've touched on one time before, I think that the most important single thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of people now in our country who are listening to this broadcast and who have been watching the events that have been transpiring in Washington, D.C., really need to understand that all of this is the culmination of events that began on December 31st of 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved. Because what happened immediately upon that event was that the extreme right-wing elements inside the George Bush Sr. administration that was in power at that time on December 31st of 1991, that we mentioned, they gathered under the auspices of the Secretary of Defense for George Bush Sr., that is Dick Cheney, his staff under Paul Wolfowitz and David Addington and Douglas Fife and Elliot Abrams and Scooter Libby and a number of them, they gathered in the White House in the West Wing, and they immediately started putting forth a document that was called the United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance Document. And what they proposed there was that now that the Soviet Union had dissolved, the United States remained now the sole superpower in the world, and that we needed to avoid the temptation of cutting our military budget now that the Soviet Union was gone, whom we had used for 75 years as the rationale for these massive military budgets of the money going to build these huge and often ineffective military weapon systems. But that instead of cutting the budget, we needed to increase the budget so that we could take advantage of this unique moment in history so as to establish full spectrum dominance over the planet. And that the purpose of that whole operation was to, in their own words, quote, maintain the continued privileged access to the strategic raw materials that were needed by members of the Northern Industrial Alliance. Now, I've got copies of that particular classified memorandum. There are others are around. I was given a copy of it by the head of peace studies for the University of New Hampshire, who sent it to me. And so we know exactly what the thought process was there. And this group organized to assert itself inside the Republican Party, saying to the Republican Party leadership, look, now that the Soviet Union is gone, there is no need for us any longer to pretend that we are not the representatives of a very tiny elite of major robber barons who came to power during the period immediately after the American Civil War, from 1868 to 1898, this 30-year period, during which the lawyers for this elite group of mercantilists created a new vehicle for business, a shareholder-owned corporation, in which the owners of all of the goods of the business are, in fact, immunized from any legal liability. They become just shareholders in the company. And the leadership of the corporation, the managers of the corporation, are immunized against any personal legal liability for the activities of the corporation. And the board of directors is immunized, basically, against any legal liability personally. And so the corporation is the only entity that is going to be held responsible legally for any of its activities. And that is, its bank account is going to be held responsible. And that's all. So what they did is they withdrew from the very heart of normal businesses, normal entrepreneurial activity on the part of industrious and very helpful elements inside our human family who are very creative and inventive and do so in exchange for a fair reward for their time and energy invested in developing products. But what they did is they now created this new vehicle that, in fact, had no person individually responsible for anything that it did. And therefore, it was an entity without a soul, without any conscience, that was, in fact, dedicated officially and exclusively to the maximization of personal profit for the corporation, which could then be distributed to the shareholders. And what happened is that it was that particular business entity that was developed during that 30-year period from 1868 to 1898 that rose to the fore and attempted to establish control over all of the natural resources in North America and expanded elsewhere into the world, primarily
using Danny, who were these people? Give us some names, corporate names, legal names.
Yeah, these are, for example, E.H. Harriman that owned most of the railway companies. It was the Rockefellers who owned Standard Oil of New Jersey and Standard Oil of California. It was, in fact, the owners of the steel mills, Carnegie. There were about 40 men, white men, that basically had exercised their own intellectual acumen to basically rise to power and to dominate and control entire areas of the economy. And that what they did is they created these corporations through their lawyers. And there was a single law firm that represented all of these people. It was Brown Brothers Harriman. And this group is the private investment company that sat and organized itself. And it was represented by a single law firm, which was Sullivan and Cromwell. And the law partners in Sullivan and Cromwell and the directors of the private investment company, Brown Brothers Harriman, joined together, and you're talking about a total of about 50 men that basically controlled all of the development and distribution of the basic resources in North America. And they began to expand out through the services of Sullivan and Cromwell, the basic law firm, to expand out into international realms, establishing transnational corporations that actually no longer even had any interest whatsoever in promoting or fostering the interests of the people of the United States. They were just dedicated to the fostering and promoting of their own financial interests. And this is what they did. And this, and it's important to recognize some of the characters here, because the CEO for Brown Brothers Harriman was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker. Now, people will remember this. They recognize that name because George H.W. Bush, the president of the United States, under the Republican Party at the time of the end of the Cold War in 1991, was in fact the grandson of George Herbert Walker. It's George Herbert Walker Bush. That's who he is. And George W. Bush, his son, is George Walker Bush, the grandson of George Herbert Walker. He was the CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman. And the lawyer for Brown Brothers Harriman was, in fact, Alan Dulles, who went on to become the first civilian director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Okay? And that this alliance between the members of Brown, the private investors in Brown Brothers Harriman, and the partners of Sullivan and Cromwell are the key to understanding this elite and how they rose to power. And we, if you track their history and what they did together, you will see that they, in fact, were the ones that responded at the end of World War I to the creation of the Soviet Union by the Bolshevik Revolution, which rose up in October of 1917 and withdrew Russia from World War I, and established the Union of Socialist Republics. And they began to advocate socialism around the world, primarily in opposition to this very group, this group of white male capitalists who were creating these corporations and being driven by this law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. And the people in the Soviet Union, the leaders, saw this group of industrialists as basically engaged in an aggressive campaign of manifest destiny, that they believed in the white man's burden. They believed that they and their allies were authorized, even by God itself, you know, to dominate the world and to exploit and develop the natural resources of the planet for purposes of enriching a tiny 0.1% of the people of the world that were white people who were the immediate family and relatives of these individual men. That's who this group was. That's where they came from. And we are living with that now, because that what happened is these people, when the Soviet Union was created in October of 1917, actually manipulated U.S.-American policy to send a U.S. military expeditionary force into Russia to try to crush this socialist revolution. And they sent them in. It was the Secretary of State under Wilson. And he was, in fact, the son-in-law of John W. Foster, who was at the height of the robber baron era in 1893. He was the Secretary of State that basically choreographed the taking over of Hawaii, the Philippine Islands, instigating the Mexican-American War, the taking over of Cuba, the entire imperialist expansion of the United States, which was characterized even by all historians as manifest destiny. It was the age of imperialism, in which they were actively engaged in attempting to lay claim to the resources, the natural resources, all across the world on behalf of their corporations. That is what was really going on. And so that what happened is when the Soviet Union was created in October of 1917, and they declared basically a worldwide campaign to try to oppose this type of manifest destiny on the part of this elite group of people, these people organized to gain control over the entire instrumentalities of the government of the United States to basically go to war against those people all around the world. And that was the actual origin of the Cold War. It was not, in fact, immediately after World War II. This began back in 1917 with Brown Brothers Harriman and the Sullivan Cromwell Law Firm basically fielding people through the instrumentalities of the United States government into the field to try to crush labor union organizing, peasant organizing, democratic organizing, trying to get people to be elected, to have control of their own natural resources, et cetera, all of which this elite group viewed to be anathema to their own personal private financial interests. And so that's where this came from. And so that it was not coincidental that the beginning of that Cold War that began in October of 1917, when it came to an end on December 31st of 1991, with the signing by Gorbachev of the decree allowing all of the republics in the Soviet Union to become free, that as soon as that Cold War came to an end, these people under George Herbert Walker Bush, the grandson of George Herbert Walker, and his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, and his staff, Wolfowitz and Addington and all of this crowd, gathered and said, look, now that the Cold War is over, now that we have vanquished those socialists from the world who have been opposing our policies, there's no longer any reason for us to disguise the fact that we actively endorse the exact same policies and principles as were advocated by our founding robber baron ancestors back during the robber baron era.
And that give us an example of that. Give us an example of that.
Well, what they said, for example, is they started talking about massively building up the United States military to be able to foray into all the countries of the world. And what they said is they wanted to organize a coalition. Now, this thing that they referred to as the New Northern Industrial Alliance, that would be made up of the United States, Canada, Mexico. Not Mexico run by the indigenous people of Mexico, but run by the PRI, which is that political party that was dominated by the Castilian Spanish conquistadors, the white people, and then also England and France and Italy and the new reunified Germany and Russia, they said. Now that Russia had spun off all of its ethnic provinces. That's a quote from the second draft of the 1992 United States Defense Department Policy Planning Guidance Document. And so you see that this is an alliance of the Caucasian countries of the world that are dominated by the transnational corporations that are run by this elite group of families and their progeny, their newly born people. And they rise into positions of power. They run this elite secret government behind the American government, behind all of the major members of the Northern Industrial Alliance, and they're dedicated to utilizing the tax money that they extract from people through the income tax system into financing the building of massive military institutions to be able to project military power into all the different countries of the world, specifically for the purpose of maintaining their continued privileged access to the strategic raw materials that are needed by this corporate elite. And that's exactly what they did at the end of World War I. That is why they set up this commission chaired by Winston Churchill in 1922, immediately after the war, and that they imposed these artificial nation-state boundaries throughout the entire Middle East, in the territory that had been the Persian Empire, that was under the control of Turkey, that had been a ally of Germany in World War I. When they were vanquished, the Western powers, under the whip hand of these men, basically established this commission that imposed these artificial nation-state boundaries all throughout the Middle East over an inherently tribal area of the world that for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, had been dominated by local tribes. And they imposed these nation-state boundaries over them because they wanted to organize those areas on behalf of these corporations. And so what they did is they imposed those boundaries and then handpicked one individual tribe and made the head of that tribe the king of that particular area. For example, Saudi Arabia. They handpicked Abdul Aziz, the head of the House of Saud, and made him the head of Saudi Arabia. They did the same thing in Iraq. They did the same thing in Iran. In Iran, they handpicked Pahlavi, the Pahlavi tribe, and made the Pahlavi the Shah of Iran. And then what they did is they negotiated these exclusive lease agreements with those families, not with the country, but with those individual families who have been put into power by the Western powers, by these elite corporate executives. They put them in charge and then had them sign a contract with the Western oil corporations, giving the Western oil corporations exclusive rights to drill and extract all of the oil from each and every one of those nation states. And they made the deal of giving from 6 to 10% of the net profits to that family. And that's how they became so completely filthy rich that everybody knows about, of the House of Saud, and the Iranian royalty, the Kuwaiti royal family, you know, all the, you know, with each of them having, you know, 25 Rolls Royces and, you know, throwing away $1 million on the roll of dice, you know, in Monte Carlo. These are those people, and they are the legates of this dominant group of elite white men who own the primary stock in all of these major corporations that were created back during the robber baron era. That's what we're seeing. And so that when they got to the end of that Cold War, by reaching out and using the rationale to maintain continued control over these resources, that anybody in those countries who attempted to exercise their indigenous rights to control or protect the natural resources of their country against exploitation by these corporate executives, they would brand them as communists. And they would say that these are agents of the communist world revolution that is attempting to overthrow democracy. And in the name of that, they would suppress democracy everywhere. They would torture anybody who tried to establish democratic institutions. They would kidnap and torture and kill any peasant groups that tried to organize cooperatives that would not allow their resources to be commandeered by the oligarchs, you know, these corporations. This is what's been going on, so that when we came to the end of this Cold War on December 31st of 1991, immediately the leadership of the Republican Party met and they said, look, we don't need to pretend any longer. Let's just be clear about the fact that we champion and extol the virtues of the robber baron era. And what you see is this is the epitome of what the Republican Party began to do starting right then. And the Democratic Party said, well, look, if they're going to move hardcore to the right wing and become openly advocating these kind of monarchical, royalist, elitist type of privileges for a tiny minority, there's no reason for us any longer to have to try to champion the poor. There's no need for us to try to champion the working class people. There's no reason for us to try to give, you know, cheap or free public education to the peasantry, you know, because we don't need to placate those people anymore, because there's no socialist movement around the world for them to join into, to oppose these policies. So they began to move more and more from shortly a little bit to the left of center, further and further to the right. So now we have an extreme right-wing party of the Republicans, and we have a straight-up conservative party with the Democrats. And the effort on the part of Bernie Sanders to establish a progressive alternative was crushed by the Democratic Party because they see them as their potential enemy, just as the Republicans do. And as you pointed out, the archetypal candidate for this new, more moderate Democratic Party became Bill Clinton. And so in 1992, the basic competition was going to go on between George H.W. Bush, seeking a second term as president, with his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, and their entire cabinet members with Wolfowitz and all these people who had generated this 1992 United States Defense Department policy planning guidance document that was calling for full-scale global dominance on the part of the United States government, that Bill Clinton was coming in with a moderate position, conservative position, and that they thought that was going to be the only contest going on between them. And it was Ross Perot that messed them up. Ross Perot, because of his knowledge about the involvement of George H.W. Bush and his people in the Iran-Contra scandal, that he ran for president against George Bush and took 19% of the vote away from him. And so George Bush Sr. ended up with only 38% of the popular vote. Bill Clinton won the presidency in 1992 with only 43% of the popular vote. And so what happened is the juggernaut of the Bush Sr., George Herbert Walker, Brown Brothers Harriman, Sullivan Cromwell agenda got kind of delayed. And it was held back temporarily by Bill Clinton and the new, more moderate Democratic Party under the leadership of Richard Gebhardt and the people in the Democratic Leadership Conference, putting out more moderate policies, abandoning labor unions, you know, taking weak, watered-down positions on environmental protection, you know, standing by and doing nothing, basically, about the whole Iran-Contra operation, you know, of smuggling drugs into the country, and et cetera. And so that's what we were seeing. That was a temporary pushback on the part of the conservatives, the mere conservatives, against the reactionaries. And so that is the general, the strategic layout of what we're looking at. And as you pointed out at the top of the discussion, that this whole group was planning to just have Hillary Clinton come into place because the Democratic Party had moved so far to the right that they were basically extolling, not to the same degree to which the right-wing Republicans were, but to the same basic principles, were extolling a transnational corporate capitalism, international finance, as the primary driver of all policies, not only in the United States, but for the entire world, and advocating globalization, the development of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. You know, and Paul Wolfowitz went right straight over to the World Bank to be the director of it. You know, this was what the plan was. And so the fact that Donald Trump came in, what really happened is, of course, you saw that in light of the fact that this elite had all lined up so completely behind Hillary Clinton and, you know, Goldman Sachs and Brown Brothers and all these people that were supporting Hillary Clinton and all the major military corporations that were all supporting her. And so it was so clear that everybody thought she was going to win the election as the Democratic Party nominee. The Republican Party decided that what they wanted to do is they wanted to establish a process for selecting their candidate, who they assumed was going to lose, but they wanted to select that person as soon as possible. And so what they did is they established a whole set of new rules that in the primaries, the presidential primaries in each of the states, they were going to adopt this rule that however many candidates were running, whichever single candidate got more votes than anybody else, got all of the delegates. So that Donald Trump, since there were 13 different candidates that were running, not just Jeb Bush, who was the obvious heir apparent to this kind of right-wing group, but, you know, like 11 other people, in addition to Donald Trump, there were 13 people running. And so in those early primaries, even though Donald Trump only got 18% of the total vote, so that like 82% of all the rest of the people was somebody else, not him, because he only got, he got 18% of the vote, and the others got 15%, 13%, 12%, 8%. He ended up getting all the delegates. And then as he started building these delegates in one of these primaries after another in 2016, as he started getting more and more of the delegates, they started saying, well, he doesn't stand a chance of winning, so let's just let him go. And what they did is they all shifted their support to Hillary. Even the leaders of the Republican Party started, you know, speaking out against Trump and saying he's not the right person, we don't want him, et cetera. And they moved their support to Hillary, so that when Trump kept on vanquishing one after another of these other 12 candidates and ended up becoming the nominee, they were flabbergasted. And they were confronted by this major question about whether they were going to support him and therefore be able to gain control over the House and Senate, to be able to get the nominees for the judges, which was really critical because the right-wing Republican Party had been blocking all the nominations by Obama, you know, in his entire second term. When the Democrats took over the Senate, Orrin Hatch from Utah chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee. He wouldn't allow a single hearing on one single nominee for the federal bench from Obama through his whole second term. So there were 159 federal judges. All of those seats opened up, and they were sitting there. And so when the Republican Party started trying to determine, or this elite group of people tried to decide whether or not they were going to support Trump, they said, well, look, if he can get in, we can get him to nominate whoever we want for judges. We can get him to nominate the most reactionary, hardcore, right-wing, Federalist Society judges, in the youngest ones possible. And we'll put them in, and we'll, like we did back during that 30-year period of the robber baron era, we'll have our major corporate lawyers in position in all of the major federal courts to do our bidding. And so they said, okay, there's going to be some advantage of this. We will probably be able to get control over him if he wins. And so that they had this kind of wishy-washy position about whether they supported him or didn't support him, but they really were hoping and thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So when they were confronted with the shock that we were all confronted by on election night in 2016, that Trump had actually won, they'd been scrambling, trying to figure out what to do about this now. And as he began to manifest all of the completely anticipated characteristics that he had, you know, which we can go on and on about, they said, oh, look, we've got to do something about this. We've got to join in coalition with the Democratic Party, and we've got to figure out how to get him out of there. And so what they did is they started creating this star chamber of having, you know, appointing a special prosecutor, Mueller, you know, who was a Republican FBI director, you know, putting him in charge, and then going out, allowing him to utilize every single draconian tool that the king's men had developed, which were basically prohibited by the Constitution of the United States because of the historical experience that our colonial people had had with those type of unjust institutions. And so they began to use those tools, using the grand jury, for example, that was designed to be a protection of individual citizens against the king's prosecutors. The king's prosecutors were not allowed to bring any type of felony charge against a private citizen unless and until a grand jury of citizens verified that there was probable cause to believe they'd committed the crime. And what these people have done is they've completely transposed the grand jury system into becoming a tool of the prosecutor. So if he tries to get someone to come and testify to him and they won't do it, he goes in front of a grand jury as their legal counsel and asks them to issue a subpoena to these people. And if they don't answer the question, they'll hold them in contempt and put them in jail until they do. This is the most extraordinary set of developments, you know, of transposing virtually all of the tools that are designed to protect a citizen against law enforcement and the executive branch are being turned on Trump now. And we're watching this thing happen. And, of course, the media are all cheering this, all, except for Fox, of course. And Fox has become completely non-credible, you know, that they're just engaged in this kind of holding operation trying to protect him. You know, they sound just like the small handful of people that protected Richard Nixon all the way to the end during the Watergate thing. even when they found out what he had done, they rationalized it. So that's what we're looking at here.
Danny, we only have a minute or two here. Let me ask you some very short questions. Just give me a yes or no.
Yep.
Would it be realistic to say that the swamp in Washington now was really created back at the behest of about 40 very powerful people that most people have heard their names, Vanderbilts, Goulds, Swearingens, that they actually created what is now the swamp? Is it also reasonable to suggest that the organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and the Business Roundtable, a lot of these are merely mouthpieces for the special interest groups that are offshoots of that original group, so that they can still control? All right?
Foreign Relations created by the Rockefellers.
Right. Yeah. It would also be reasonable to suggest that war is profitable to them, controlling our budget, controlling who gets into offices that are important to them, and that you won't see a name like Rockefeller or Morgan or Harriman, but their descendants and corporate people that they have passed down reins of power continue to rule by controlling the interest in corporations, including the different Federal Reserve banks.
That's absolutely true.
Okay. Well, that gives us perspective, and that's what we wanted from you, and you have laid it out as usual. Danny, thank you so much, because you have shown us not only the creation of the swamp, but the swamp creatures inside. You've given a face and a name to them, and it gives us a much better perspective. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, you're more than welcome, Gary. Thank everybody for listening.
Okay, and Danny Sheehan, my guest, this has been a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds and a different look at the deep state. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me, sister, with brutality, sister. Talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on.